This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 131.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with Hal Elrod, author of the book, The Miracle Morning, about how to transform your life before 8 a.m. And in the quick tip segment, Angie answers a listener question about sickness and marathon training. How to know if it's safe to continue running if you come down with some kind of sickness. And to get our help in taking your health and fitness to the next level, find out how to become an official Academy member and interact with us in our awesome online community by visiting MarathonTrainingAcademy.com and clicking on the Join the Academy page. Well, Angie, while we have the music playing, why don't you read this email we got from Richard from the UK?
Okay. He says, "Hey, guys, I love listening to your podcast, full of really interesting stuff, funny and relatable."
Thank you.
"I'm a middle of the group, half or full marathoner, and I'm currently training for the Manchester Marathon in April. I have a love-hate relationship with the music intros on the podcast. Sometimes it really irritates me. I don't know why. And other times, like today, I find I'm singing it all day. What is that about? I wonder who's the group. Thanks, Richard from the UK."
So he's saying sometimes he hates it and sometimes he loves it.
Maybe he hates it because he can't get it out of his head. I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, Richard. Yeah, the group is the Acapella Company, and it's not spelled like the word acapella is usually spelled. I can't tell you how to spell it, though, because I don't remember off the top of my head. Yeah, the Acapella Company, and we got permission to play it on the podcast as our intro, so we've been playing it ever since.
You guys are stuck with it.
But the whole idea is we want everyone to get well on their way to reaching their running goals and becoming a better version of themselves.
That's right. I also got a note from Rhonda. She says, "I just wanted to say thank you for all the wonderful podcasts. Last Sunday, I ran a 50K in Waco, Texas called the Miracle Match. In the past years, I've run the half and the marathon. This was the first year for their ultra. My time was 7 hours, 15 minutes, and 56 seconds, which I was very happy with. The hills are unbelievable, but fun. Because I was out there for so long, I needed entertainment. I went back and listened to several of my favorite MTA podcasts. There is always value in each one. I always learn something new or get inspiration or a new mantra. Here's to many more years of great running and lots more MTA." And that comes from Rhonda, who we interviewed on episode 125.
Yeah, she has gone through multiple brain surgeries, and she's a big inspiration. And if you haven't heard that episode with her, you should go back and get 125. It'll really encourage you. So thank you, Rhonda, for that nice note, and thank you for being a longtime listener.
That's right, and congratulations on that 50K. Sounds great.
Yeah. So, Angie, what else is going on? How's your running been going lately?
It's been going well. Yeah, I'm officially training for Boston right now. Jumped right back into that after we got back from our cruise, and it's going well. Just had a 16-mile run this morning and got to see a red fox that ran right in front of me, and there was a pond I ran around that had over 100 Canada geese there, so that was pretty neat to see. And yeah, just enjoyed being out in nature this morning.
Well, we're excited about this episode because we're going to be talking with an author and speaker named Hal Elrod, and sometimes he goes by Yo Pal Hal. That was his radio name when he did a little bit of radio when he was younger. But this guy's got an amazing story because at 20 years of age, he was hit by a drunk driver and pronounced dead at the scene. They were able to bring him back to life, obviously. But his body was so busted up that he was told he'd never walk again. He's one of the most positive guys I've ever talked to. He's got incredible energy. That his energy alone has really taught me a whole lot. You know, that's one thing that I'm really taking away from this interview. But he did make a recovery from that accident, and he went on to do an ultra marathon, which we'll ask him about. And then we'll also, of course, talk about his book, The Miracle Morning, and get into the tips and strategies for having the most productive and transformative mornings that we can have. Which, by the way, folks, between Angie and I, which one do you think is a night person, stays up till 12, and which one do you think is a morning person? Now, if you said Trevor's a night person, you'd be correct. Angie, I don't think I've ever seen you stay up till 12.
Only when I had babies that were getting me up at night.
Yeah.
I realized then that there's really no good reason to be up that late.
Yeah.
Even for New Year's Eve, I can hardly make it.
And by the way, I did a little survey on our members' Facebook group, and I asked the folks in there, how many of you are morning people and how many are night owls. And I think most folks are morning people.
And most people guessed correctly that you were the night owl and I was the morning person.
But there's some other night owls in there, you know, besides me. So.
And I think it was funny, some people said both, which I envy them. And some people said neither. So
sometimes I feel that way, yeah.
So that thought was interesting. I think as a general rule, runners tend to gravitate more towards mornings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's always the exception. So I'm sure there's a breakdown in the percentages somewhere there.
So you usually run in the morning, Angie. Talk about how important your morning routine is to you.
Well, I guess it's really important to me because if I didn't run in the morning, it wouldn't happen. As a mother of three young children and, you know, being busy, working, things like that, if I don't get up right away and get going, then, you know, the day just starts happening. People have demands on my time and attention, and the run is very hard to get in. So, yeah, I get up early and do some meditation, go out for my run, and then come back with the energy and the focus to face three little boys in the morning, getting them off to school, and starting my work with, you know, energy and enthusiasm.
Right on. And would you say that there's room for improvement, though, even though it sounds like that's a pretty good morning?
Yes, that's one of the reasons I was excited about getting Hal's book and then having him on the podcast. I didn't just buy the book for you.
It's good to know. All right, so let's go ahead and get into our interview with Hal right now. It's a beautiful. All right, we're on the podcast today with Hal Elrod. He's a motivational speaker, success coach, and best-selling author of The Miracle Morning, the not-so-obvious secret guaranteed to transform your life before 8 a.m. At 20 years of age, Hal was hit head-on by a drunk driver traveling 70 miles an hour. Despite being pronounced clinically dead for 6 minutes and spending 6 days in a coma and being told he'd never walk again, he made a comeback and went on to become a runner and even completed an ultramarathon. Hal lives in California with his wife and two children. So, Hal, welcome to the podcast.
Trevor, thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here, man. This is exciting.
Well, I heard you on another podcast, and I thought right away that, wow, I need to get that book, Miracle Morning.
Actually, I heard him first on a podcast. I told you about it.
Right.
But you didn't listen, and then you came up with the idea later.
I spaced it.
I had actually ordered the book, and then he was telling me about this podcast he'd heard. I'm like, yeah, I already ordered the book. It sounds awesome.
That's awesome. She knows me so well.
You know. As always, our wives are much smarter than we are. And yeah, my wife, always, I'll bring some. She's like, I told you that 100 times. And I'm like, oh, but I just heard it from my friend. And yeah, she's like, glad you listened to your friend. So anyway.
Well, we're excited to talk to you today. We got a lot that we want to ask you. First of all, can you take us back to the crash and the events leading up to that moment?
Yeah, at that time in my life, I was really riding kind of riding on top of the world. I felt like I was on top of the world. I was a top record-breaking sales rep for Cutco Cutlery. I sold kitchen knives. I never imagined I'd be in sales. A friend of mine kind of talked me into it, and I just 10 days in, I had broken the all-time company record for the most ever sold in the first 10 days.
We have Cutco.
Yeah, we do.
You guys have Cutco?
Yeah.
So you know it sells itself, right? So the only reason I sold a lot is I was enthusiastic and I worked hard. I didn't have any skills, you know? But as one of the top sales reps, I was always asked to speak at all of their events. So one night I spoke at their event. I had just bought a brand new Ford Mustang 3 weeks prior, you know, shiny white, 5-speed, kind of my dream car at, you know, 20 years old. And driving home that night after I gave my speech, I mean, my last memory is really feeling grateful. I'd gotten a standing ovation for the first time in my life, you know, so that was really cool. And I remember wanting to call my mom and dad to tell them how great the night went. But when I looked at the clock on the dash of my car, I thought, you know what? They're probably in bed. I better wait. Little did I know what was about to happen. But at around 11:34 p.m., a drunk driver doing 80 miles an hour in a full-size Chevy truck, much larger than my little Ford Mustang. I don't remember the headlights coming at me, barreling down the highway, but he did. And his full-size Chevy truck crashed head-on into my Mustang, both of us traveling at over 70 miles an hour, crushing the front of my car, exploding the airbag, shattering the windshield, and my car went spinning. And the worst was yet to come. As my car spun sideways, the car behind me didn't have time to even hit their brakes, according to the driver. They just crashed at 70 miles an hour into the door of my car. And I usually tell people when I'm speaking, I say, look over, put your hands up like they're on the steering wheel, look over to your left, and just imagine a car going 70 miles an hour just hit you in the door, just give kind of a perspective.
Yeah.
And what happened is what you might imagine happened. I immediately, the entire left side of my body was just devastated. I broke 11 bones, punctured my lung, ruptured my spleen. My ear was almost completely severed, and I began bleeding. As you mentioned, it was ended up being bleeding to death. And an hour later, they pulled me out of the car. I died for 6 minutes in a coma for 6 days. Doctors said I would never walk again. And 3 weeks later, you can say miraculously, but I took my first step and got back to the road to recovery.
Do you have any memory of this at all, or is this just kind of reconstructed from?
Yeah, my first memory, or my last memory, was thinking about, actually, it was getting on the freeway. My best friend Jeremy got stuck at the red light, and I literally remember thinking, too bad for him. That was my last thought, right? He got stuck at the red light. Really, it was too bad for me, of course, but. And then my first, I don't remember the crash. I don't remember dying. I'm often asked, did you see the light and all of that? I don't know. I don't remember, because I suffered such a significant brain damage from the head-on collision that my short-term memory was pretty much wiped out. And came out of the coma 6 days later, and I don't remember the first week being out of the coma. I was alive. I was awake. I was responsive. I was talking to my parents. But I only, as you, that's a great word, I only have reconstructed what that first week was like from stories from my mom and dad and my sister and my friends and doctors and nurses and that sort of thing.
So what happened to the other people involved?
So the drunk, nobody else was seriously injured. The drunk driver, couple scrapes and bruises. The family of three that hit me, they were, nobody was injured. My girlfriend at the time was in the car with me, believe it or not. And even she sprained her shoulder. That was it. All of the impact really happened to me, the majority to me, and mostly from that side impact. But when I came out of the coma and, told I would never walk again, 3 weeks later, I took my first step. And I think there's such an important lesson in this that the doctor said I would never walk again. And I told my parents, I said, look, the doctors might be experts in medicine, but they're not experts in me, right? And I think that's so important that we can never let the fears, the insecurities, and the limiting beliefs of other people limit what's possible for us. And we do it all the time.
Yeah.
We know if our friends think small, we think small. If our family's negative, we're negative. You know what I mean? We get trapped. I mean, it's like Jim Rohn said, we're the average of the five people we spend the most time with. So I just said, look, if I never walk again, I have fully accepted that. I said, I will be the happiest person you've ever seen in a wheelchair. That's what I told my parents.
Wow.
I said, but I'm not putting, I said, so I've accepted the worst case scenario and I can be at peace with it. I said, but I'm putting zero energy into worrying about that. All of my energy is going into visualizing walking again, imagining it, praying about it, thinking about it. So instead of dwelling on what could be the worst case scenario, I've accepted that. I'm at peace with it. I'm focusing on what I want. And I don't think it's a coincidence that 3 weeks after the night of the crash, 2 weeks after coming out of the coma, and a week after telling my mom and dad that I was focusing on walking again and visualizing it every day, a week after that conversation, the doctors came in with routine x-rays and they said, Hal, my mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Elrod, we don't know how to explain this, but your body is healing incredibly. We're going to let you take your first step today in therapy. It was like, what? I mean, I was optimistic, but I was like thinking maybe in a year, and 3 weeks later, I took my first step and got back to work within a matter of a month.
Wow. This mindset you had was the mindset at 20 years old and your body's all busted up. I've seen the pictures. It's just awful. And there you are in the hospital and people are telling you, you're never going to walk again, but you just knew you were going to walk again. I mean, how did you get that mindset in that moment?
Here's the thing. I didn't know I was going to walk again at all. And I think that's what prevents a lot of people from positive thinking or visualization or maintaining faith, because they have the fear of failure. I knew that. In fact, if I was a betting man, I probably would have bet that I wasn't going to walk. Like, that logic said that. But it's interesting you ask that, because I've never been asked that question in this way, or I've never thought of the answer in this way. When I was in sales, there was this one time where I was trying to break the all-time company record, and I was trying to sell $20,000 in a 10-day period. And my first 7 days, I was at $7,000. So imagine working, giving it everything you have. You sell $7,000 in 7 days, and then you're 13,000 away from your goal, and you have 3 days left to go, right? Statistically, logically, nothing said that that was possible. But in that moment, I decided, look, if I'm going to make what I called, you know, a miracle at that time happen, if I'm going to sell $13,000 in 3 days, the only way I'm going to do it is with unwavering faith. I've got to, even though I know it might not happen and it probably won't, I'm going to put all my energy into saying, I'm going to sell $20,000. I'm going to sell $20,000. That no matter what, there's no other option. I'm going for it, while I simultaneously accepted that I might not. Hmm. And what happened was, it was a miracle the way that I ended up selling those $13,000 in the last 3 days. It was like, it was just crazy the way that it happened. And I was like, wow. And I called that my miracle equation. And I started using it over and over and over again and breaking record after record after record. And almost always in that miraculous fashion where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not on track for the goal. There's no way it's going to happen. It doesn't look very good. But I just decided I'm going to maintain unwavering faith despite the fact that it may not happen. And what happened is I just applied that lesson to the walking. I went, you know what? Yeah, there's a good chance I'm never going to walk again. I get that. It may be a fact at this point, but until I'm proven otherwise, right, just like I did in my sales competition, until the last moment is up, until there's no other opportunity to try again, I'm committed to give it everything I have. And I just took that lesson and I applied it to the walking, and, you know, in the same fashion that, you know, that miracle happened.
So how did you go from having to relearn how to walk to eventually start running and then training for a marathon and ultra marathon? I mean, that's a big jump right there.
Yeah, there was no really running in between. What happened was so if you fast forward, in life I say I've had two rock bottoms, and I think we've all had rock bottoms where it's that time, those times in our lives where at that moment you've never dealt with anything so difficult, right? And like when I got broken up with by my girlfriend in seventh grade was, you know, technically my first rock bottom. I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to go to school, or, you know, life was over as I knew it. So rock bottoms are very relative. Well, when I was 20 and the car accident happened, that to me was the first really monumental rock bottom that I had to overcome. And then 8 or 9 years later, when the U.S. economy crashed, that was my second rock bottom. And what happened was I had a six-figure business at the time. I was a coach doing success coaching, sales coaching, life coaching, business coaching. And I had launched a speaking career, and my first book, Taking Life Head On, had been published. So, and I had just bought my first house. I had bought my dream car. It was, again, kind of like the first rock bottom, back on top, like life is great, which I'm always knocking on wood, you know, after these experiences. But then the U.S. economy crashed, and almost overnight, I lost my business, I lost my income, I lost my house, I got deeply depressed, I was in the worst shape of my life physically. And to keep a long story short, a friend of mine called me, or I called him, and I finally said, hey, I have not told anyone this, man, but I'm struggling. Like, I literally was crying. I'm like, I need your help right now. It's my best friend, John. And I told him what had happened. And I poured my heart out to John, right? And I'm like, it was really hard, and then I said, John, I'm sitting here with a pen and paper or my computer, whichever it was, and I'm ready to take notes. Tell me how to turn this around, man. I need to get out of this hole. And his response pissed me off. He said, are you exercising every day? And I go, what the hell does that have to do with anything I just told you? And I thought, you know, I'm picturing him on the other end of the phone, just, or, you know, on his phone playing a game or something, not even paying attention to me as I pour my heart out. And he goes, Hal, I'm dead serious. He goes, look, you're a smart guy, but if you're not getting blood and oxygen, you know, to your brain and getting, putting in, releasing serotonin, if you're not putting yourself in a peak physical state every day, you're not going to turn this around. You're a smart guy, but you can't. So, and I was like, John, and here's what I said. I said, John, I hate running though. He said, what do you hate worse, running or your current life situation? And I was like, all right, screw you. Okay, I'll go for a run. And so the next morning, I literally went for my first run. I was, what, 27 years old, since I had to run in PE class in high school. I hated running, literally. I don't use that word for very many things. And I go for a run, and 2 minutes into my run, I hear a quote from Jim Rohn that would really become the catalyst that turned my life around faster than I ever thought possible. And the quote from Jim Rohn, he said, your level of success will seldom exceed your level of personal development. Mm-hmm. And I realized in that moment, I'm not dedicating time each day to my personal development. Therefore, I'm not dedicating time to become the person that I need to be that is capable of creating and attracting and sustaining the levels of success that I want. And I ran home and I created what is, you know, now known as the Miracle Morning. But part of my Miracle Morning, I went, wow, if I just got more clarity in 2 minutes of running than in 6 months of not running, I thought, I think I'm going to give this a try. And I knew my friend John Vroman founded a charity called the Front Row Foundation, and they did an annual run to raise money. And I thought, I'm going to do like a 10K or something, which at that time was like, I've never run more than a mile, right? And then I told my friend John, I said, hey, man, I went for a run. I created this thing. It wasn't called the Miracle Morning. But what ended up happening was I decided during that Miracle Morning that I was going to do the 10K, and John teased me. He goes, oh, that's cool. You can do the 10K with the other grandmothers out there doing their 10Ks. And then I thought, okay, man, I'll do like a half marathon. And then just mentally it kept growing. Once I committed that I could run a half marathon, I thought, well, then if I could run a half marathon, I could run a whole marathon. And as someone who was as inexperienced and naive as I was, which was my biggest benefit at that point, because I went, you know what? If I could run 26 miles, considering right now I can't even run one, then why couldn't I run 52 miles? That's literally the logic. And I'm like, that's more impressive. I'm going to do that. So that's why I decided to do the 52-mile marathon. And it took 5 months. 5 months later, and I think I ran 600 miles along the journey. And then I completed and I don't say I ran an ultra marathon. I crawled, I limped, I walked, I popped ibuprofen multiple times. It was the worst day of my life and the best day of my life. But that's the journey that I took to get there.
And I think I read somewhere that it was it Atlantic City Marathon that you did a double on that one?
Yeah. So what happened is we showed up. The marathon started at like 8 a.m. And me and when I say we, I convinced three of my coaching clients to do it with me. Again, these guys weren't runners either. I'm just like, do it. And they're like, okay, Hal, you know, I'm their coach. So they're like, sure. and so we met at the course at 3 o'clock in the morning, and we ran a marathon before the marathon started. And then we ran the marathon that was, you know, the Atlantic City Marathon.
Yeah. So you still run, or that whole thing just ruin it for you?
No, it was a bucket list item. That's why when people introduce me as, and he's an ultra marathon runner, I go, no, that's deceiving. That makes it sound like I would do more than one of these. It was really a check it off the bucket list. And I just was thinking, like, when I really was thinking through the whole thing, I thought, man, what would be more profound than to go from being told I'd never walk again to really prove that we're all capable of anything that we set our mind to? You know, I mean, it's cliche, but it's so true, right? And I thought, ever since my accident, I felt this sense of responsibility to kind of do things that set the example for other people. You know, I've just always, I felt that way in the hospital. And so that marathon was kind of one of those things.
That's awesome. I've got to say, I've really enjoyed reading The Miracle Morning. And would you just kind of walk us through the six practices that make up The Miracle Morning?
Yeah, absolutely. I ran home that morning after, you know, I had this epiphany and heard that Jim Rohn quote, and my realization was I've got to dedicate time to personal development. But that's such a vague topic. Like what in the heck is personal development, right? I mean, and so I Googled like best personal development practices and, you know, personal development of the most successful people. And I spent like an hour doing some research, and I basically came up with these six practices that I wrote down. And here's the thing, I almost scrapped the whole idea because I had heard of all six of them. And, you know, we're conditioned, we're always looking for like the silver bullet, the app that'll solve our problems. And I wrote, here's the six things: meditation, affirmations, visualization, exercise, reading, and journaling. And I thought, well, none of those are new, eh? Like, those are like been around since before time. I mean, come on. And as I almost dismissed it, I went, wait a minute, some of the most successful people in the world swear by any one of these practices. And this was my epiphany. I thought, what if I did all six? You know, I mean, there are people like Russell Simmons wrote a book called Success Through Stillness, right? Mm-hmm. Multimillionaire entrepreneur. And he basically credits meditation as the source of his success. Ray Dalio, who is he runs the largest hedge fund in the world. He's a billionaire. He says meditation is the secret of success, right? I saw Will Smith on Ellen, and he said affirmations are the key to his success, right? Jim Carrey famously told Oprah that visualization is the key to his success. I was trying to figure out, well, which one of these is like going to give me the biggest bang for the buck? And then I went, wait a minute, I'm really at a crappy place in my life right now. I want to turn this around as fast as possible. What if I didn't pick or choose the best one? What if I did all six of them? And the next morning I decided, I'm not a morning person, but man, I want to take my life to the next level. I'm going to wake up an hour earlier. And I had to wake up at 6 a.m. every day for work. It's my own work, but that's when I woke up. So it was 5 a.m., which seemed crazy to me. And anyone listening right now, you're like, yeah, right. Like, you're about to turn the podcast off because you're like, I'm not a morning person, dude. Screw waking up at 5 a.m. First of all, you don't have to wake up at 5 a.m. miracle mornings about waking up earlier than you have to wake up, right? And that's a big principle, is because when you have to wake up and you wake up when you have to, it's like a sense of mediocrity to start your day. It's called the mediocre morning. I'm going to get up at the last possible minute to not get fired, right? Like,
I specialize in those kind of mornings.
Okay, all right. So you got to get on.
Lots of tension in our house in the morning.
I love it. So the six practices. I woke up in the morning and I didn't know how to meditate. So I Googled how to meditate. I Googled how to do affirmations. I Googled how to visualize. I Googled, you know, right. I knew how to exercise, obviously. Journaling, didn't really know how to do that. So I go through these six practices, and the next morning I go through all six of them and I'm like horrible at them. I mean, I'm the worst meditator ever, right? You're supposed to, you know, like clear your mind, quiet your mind. And I'm like, oh, I have like a million thoughts racing, right?
Yes.
I'm doing yoga in the morning. I didn't know how to do yoga. I just like put on a yoga DVD that my wife had. And I'm like the most unflexible person ever, right? So I'm doing visualizing. Yeah, so I'm like bad at all of them. But this was the turning point in my life. At 6 a.m., after I had gone through all six of the practices, which are now known as the Life Savers, and Savers is the acronym. If anybody's taking notes, here are the Life Savers. The first S is for silence, A for affirmations, V for visualization, E for exercise, R for reading, and the final S is for scribing. So silence, affirmations, visualization, exercise, reading, and scribing. Those are the six practices. And at 6 a.m. that morning, here's the thing is my life was still a mess, right? I was still months away from losing the house. I was $50,000 in credit card debt, personal credit card debt, which I had racked up. And I was like a credit card. I was a no credit card guy. And when the economy crashed in 5 or 6 months, I had racked up $50,000 in credit card debt, just trying to survive. And I had canceled my gym membership and I was in the worst shape of my life. And I was deeply depressed to the point of being suicidal, deeply depressed. And that morning at 6 a.m. after this 1 hour routine, again, it wasn't called the Miracle Morning. It wasn't going to be a book. It was like my desperate attempt to take my life to the next level. And at 6 a.m., I felt amazing. And that's the thing. I went, wow, if I could, when I say amazing, I mean, I felt energized. I felt motivated. I felt like I had more clarity than I had in the last 6 months of depression, right? My depression was gone. I didn't feel depressed anymore. And I went, if I could start every day feeling this way, well, then this is the key. This is the one thing that could change everything for me. And I didn't know how fast it would happen. But in less than 2 months, I more than doubled my income. I just took what I was currently doing, which was coaching, and I figured out how to triple my clients. That was it. And my depression was gone. And I went from being in the worst shape of my life physically to, as we just talked about, 5 months later, you know, I started running that day. And 5 months later, I ran the ultra marathon. And because my life turned around so quickly, I started calling it my miracle morning. But I was never going to share it. And it's just, I told a coaching client, she told a friend, I told another. And it just kind of organically started spreading. And then 2 years ago, the book came out. And kind of, as they say, the rest is history, you know?
As a morning person, this really resonates with me because I feel the best in the morning. And, you know, I haven't incorporated all of these into my life yet, but I've got three of them that I'm currently doing, so I can definitely see adding the other three in, you know, is really going to step things up as well. But, you know, talk to the person who, like you said, is not a morning person. What are some really concrete suggestions to help them get going and incorporate these steps?
Yeah, I would say that's probably 70%, just based on like surveys and this and that and research and, you know, statistics published in magazines. Roughly 70 to 80% of the people in America do not consider themselves morning people, right? And I thought it was less than that. I thought it was like 90% didn't consider, you know, so 70, 80%, at least 20 to 30 do. But here's the point. Like if you go to Amazon.com right now and you go read through the reviews on the Miracle Morning book, right? I'm pretty excited. We just had our 600th five-star review, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you very much. But most of them will tell you, before this book, I was not a morning person. I hated mornings. In fact, one of my favorite reviews, she said, I've been avoiding this book for like 4 months. I've had multiple friends tell me it'll change my life, and I just avoid it. And I think that, yeah, the majority of people that do the Miracle Morning were not morning people at all, and that includes me. I wasn't a morning person, right? And so I think that probably the most important part of the Miracle Morning book is the shortest chapter in the book. And it's called the 5-Step Snooze-Proof Wake-Up Strategy for the Snoozeaholic. Long subject line.
I probably read that and underlined everything in that chapter.
Well, it's funny because I just spoke to a group of CEOs in New York. There were 50 CEOs, and the CEO that introduced me, David Schnurman, he's the CEO of Lawline.com, and he came up and he said, he right at the end of the introduction, he said, by the way, I don't know if Hal's going to mention this, but he has this little chapter in his book called The 5-Step Snooze-Proof Wake-Up Strategy. When I first read it, I thought, these are so basic. You know, these are like, again, we're always looking for something that's, you know, fancy or complex. He said, but I'll tell you what, I decided, since I was having trouble waking up, I followed him. If it wasn't for these little simple steps that my, you know, first grade daughter could do, he said, I would be hitting the snooze button every time. But I do the steps. And I'll give you guys, I'll share the most important steps. Number one, night before, you got to set your intentions for what you're going to do when you wake up in the morning. Most people go to sleep going, ah, I'm tired. I got to wake up in 6 hours. Then the alarm goes off and their last thought before bed is their first thought in the morning. Oh my gosh, it's already been 6 hours, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to create a powerful intention before you go to bed. And the way I like to compare it is I think about mornings when it's not hard to wake up. Think about a morning in your life, whether it was Christmas morning as a kid or, you know, going on vacation or your first day of school. You guys, is it hard to wake up on those days?
No.
No, because you literally set your intention the night before. Oh, my gosh, I can't wake up to wake up in the morning. Can't wait. And the reality is what ends up happening is you literally the morning happens and you're ready to go. The alarm goes off. You're like, oh, my gosh. It's a vacation day or it's Christmas day or it's whatever. And so I realized that we could create that every single day of our lives. Second thing you got to do is move your alarm clock as far away from the bed as possible. Most people have it on the nightstand. And this was actually, that's the one step that the CEO that introduced me, that's the one he mentioned. He goes, I move my alarm clock across the room. It's a game changer. Because think about it. If it's within arm's reach, you're like 80% asleep when it goes off and you make that decision like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. And it, you'll lose the battle every time. So the alarm clock has to be far away from the room. And when you set your intention the night before, which, by the way, in the book, I've got this whole, you know, bedtime affirmation, word for word, how to set your intention before you go to bed. You don't have to make it up. Hmm. But then before you go to bed, you go, okay, when the alarm clock goes off, I'm going to get out of bed, turn it off because you have to. And then I'm going to go directly from there to the bathroom to, and then for me, I have a full glass of water on the bathroom counter. And that's the next step is you've got to rehydrate. Because we are dehydrated by default when the alarm clock goes off. You've got to drink a full glass of water and immediately rehydrate. So you're, and then brush your teeth, you know, wash your face, jump in the shower, whatever you got to do. But those steps are designed to be so easy that you can do them while you're half asleep. So that when you're done doing them at the end of the fifth step, you're like, huh, I feel kind of awake now. And it's much easier to have the discipline to get yourself out of bed.
I'm going to do it tomorrow.
No, tonight. Move the alarm clock tonight. I always say a miracle morning starts with a miracle evening. So,
I think I'll hide the alarm clock for you. And
I don't know what the deal was, but I had trouble getting up as early as I wanted to today. And I even moved the alarm clock across the room last night, but I just got up, turned it off, went back.
So there's that setting your intentions. You got to really set a powerful intention before bed that no matter how I feel, when the alarm clock goes off, I'm going straight to the bathroom to brush my teeth. And and get started.
I think you should write a book called The Miracle Evening.
I know I've been told that it'll probably come out someday. I'll probably do a Miracle Morning 2.0 someday. Like maybe on the 5th anniversary or the 10th anniversary or something. And now incorporate some, you know, make it a longer book with more advanced stuff.
I think setting your intentions is so powerful because I'm a morning person. I don't have trouble getting up in the morning, but I really feel victim to the, oh no, I'm only going to get less than 7 hours of sleep or whatever the number was. And so then I would wake up feeling tired and I would still get up and go about my routine, but it kind of started the day off on a negative note. And so now, you know, really being intentional about thinking like, wow, I'm so glad I get 7 hours of sleep or 6.5 or whatever it is. And, you know, I'm going to feel great and I'm going to go about my routine in the morning. And I think that's really been powerful for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's one of the limiting beliefs I address in the book is there's a whole section. I don't know if it's a whole chapter, but there's a section on how much sleep do we really need. And I talk about the mind-body connection. And there are a lot of the most successful people in the world, in the history of the world, like Albert Einstein and Thomas Edison, right? They slept 4, 5, 6 hours a night, no problem. And I really, I believe. And then there's science that shows it all. There's science that shows you need 8 hours. There's science. Recently, an article came out. There's scientific backing saying 6.5 hours is ideal, right? Mm. But I'm a big believer that if you go to bed and you tell yourself, I'm going to be rejuvenated and, you know, off of 6 hours of sleep or five, you know, that you can make it happen. And that's my real life experience. I don't know, you know, I'm not making these bold claims that say the research I've done over, you know, studying millions of people. I just my own experience. And I kind of go, look, the doctor said I would never walk again, but if I could believe that I was going to walk in and that could heal my body, I think that you could get by off 6 hours of sleep. That's just my opinion.
The mind is very powerful. You're right. And it really influences a lot of, you know, our experience and even our physical function. So
and we create our reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this book, especially if you feel like your morning routine needs an extra boost or you don't have a morning routine. I think it'll be really powerful for people, especially in marathon training when it's very helpful to do your exercise in the morning so it doesn't get lost in, you know, the clutter. So,
yeah, absolutely.
All right. What would you say, final word to like someone who is still needs an extra word of encouragement to take action in the morning?
Yeah, I'll say two things. Number one, and this is actually a quote from the book Secrets of the Millionaire Mind by T. Harv Eker. He said, "How you do anything is how you do everything." And I believe that, right? Meaning that if you're disorganized in one area, it's probably not the only area. If you get into somebody's car that's a mess, I bet that's not the only part of their life that's a mess, right? So if you think about it, if you really understand that philosophy, it means that everything you do, you have to treat with a lot of importance, right? I call it isolating incidents. People isolate incidents. They think, well, this one cheeseburger won't matter, but that's probably not the one cheeseburger you're going to eat this month then, right? So here's the point. When the alarm clock goes off in the morning, you're faced with a choice. We all claim to want an extraordinary, successful life. And when the alarm clock goes off in the morning, I believe that's life's first gift to all of us. And it's also life's first challenge and life's first test. And it's saying, do you have the discipline to get out of bed? Therefore, you become a disciplined person so that you can lose the weight you want to lose, make the money you want to make, you know, do the things that you need to do that require discipline. Or do you start your day with procrastination and hit the snooze button 3 times? And therefore, how you do anything is how you do everything. You're starting your day with a lack of discipline and with procrastination. So that's my encouragement, is to realize that do a 30-day challenge. Just set the alarm clock 30 minutes earlier. Whether, you know, you read The Miracle Morning or not, realize that how you start your day significantly impacts your quality of life. And the last thing I'll say on that is the number one cause of mediocrity and regret in our lives is never deciding that now is the most important time in our lives. It's thinking, it's a good idea. I'll try tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow, guess what? How you do anything is how you do everything. So if you put it off till tomorrow today, you're going to put it off till tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And Robin Sharma said it really well. The saddest thing in life is to wake up one day and realize you could have been, done, and had so much more. The only way to ensure that doesn't happen is to wake up tomorrow and decide that today is the most important day of your life, and dedicate some time in the morning to becoming the person that you need to be to make that a reality.
All right. Good words, man. That's what I needed to hear. And I
hope, get your butt out of bed.
Right on, Hal. Okay, so right, people wanted to find you online and read more and check out more. Where do they need to go?
So you can go to my website, Hal Elrod, H-A-L-E-L-R-O-D, halelrod.com. If somebody's listening and you're like, you know what, The Miracle Morning is interesting, but I'm like, let's say you're tight on money. I've been there before where I was so tight on money that I couldn't spend an extra $15 on something that wasn't food, right? I've been there. If you want to get started with The Miracle Morning, but you don't have the funds to go to Amazon and buy the book, or if you're just skeptical, right, and you're like, I'm not ready to buy the book, you can go to miraclemorning.com, and you'll get the first few chapters for free. They will be emailed to you. You will get a 17-minute video that is actually me on stage sharing The Miracle Morning with thousands of people, and you'll get a 60-minute in-depth audio training all for free, and I'll never spam you, name it. And then last but not least, I would invite everybody to come check out the Miracle Morning community on Facebook. I've never seen an online community that is as engaged and inspired and positive and encouraging and supportive as ours. And the first month, you know, maybe 10 people asked to join, and it got to where then 100 people a month and 100 people every couple of weeks. And now it's over 100 people a day, and I don't do anything. I try to check in there at least a few times a week, and I post and I comment and, you know, and read stuff and like stuff just to stay engaged. But 99% of the engagement is my community members with each other. If I died today, I think that community would grow to millions of people over the next, you know, few years or 10 years or whatever. It's just growing because I don't do anything to make it grow.
Well, you're leading a movement.
Yeah, it really has. I call it the Miracle Morning Mission because I was calling it the Miracle Morning Movement, which it is. But then I had three different people say, I think of like a bowel movement first thing when you wake up. So I decided to...
They might be helpful too.
After the third person said the same thing in different contexts, I'm like, all right, I'm gonna make it a mission. So yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate that. And it's, I'm humbled. I feel very small. Someone the other day I was speaking and they go, wow, you must be so proud of all of this, you know, how big this has gotten, how many people it's impacting. And it was interesting. I kind of just paused and I thought, and I looked, I said, you know what? Proud is not the word. I said, I don't feel any sense of pride at all. I said, maybe I should. I don't know. But I said, I feel I'm more in awe. Humbled is a word that resonates. Awe is a word that resonates with me, you know, but not pride. But yeah, I'm just grateful. I feel like, you know, I don't know, God working through me. The collective, it's everything. I didn't invent any of it. I'm just the messenger, I guess, if that makes sense. So, but thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, it's been good talking with you today, Hal. Thank you for taking your time. And The Miracle Morning has been a very helpful book for Angie and I. Well, more for me because she's already pretty disciplined. But the affirmations have been really helpful to me, just really getting my mind in the right place first thing in the morning, which is when it matters the most. So just want to say thanks for the book, and I'll be heading over to Amazon, leaving another 5-star review for you. So
I appreciate that. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. And everybody that listened, I hope you got some value today. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to connecting with everybody in the future.
Well, we appreciate Hal Elrod for coming on the MTA podcast and just helping us get some ideas and principles for making morning times more effective. And Angie, give us a snapshot of your morning. This is a Saturday. We're recording this. So what did you do?
I got up and did a few minutes of meditation and got ready for my long run. Went out and ran 16 miles, cleaned up, did a few morning chores, you know, showered, all that good stuff, and got a little work done. And now we're sitting down to record.
So when you did your meditation, what was that like?
I mean, everyone approaches what they do for meditation a little bit differently. And I actually will just put 10 minutes on the timer on our stove. And then I sit down in a comfortable cross-legged position and just focus on my breath. And sometimes I'll even count. Inhale for a count of 8, exhale for a count of 8. Just because otherwise my mind starts going in different directions if I don't have something to focus my mind.
What you're saying is you focus on your breathing.
Yeah, I'm focusing on deep breathing mainly.
So that's the good way to clear your mind. You can tell I know nothing about meditation.
Well, there's a lot of different types of meditation. And I think, you know, there's not one size that fits all. But that's what I've found has been very helpful. And I've been doing that for the last, I don't know, maybe over 2 months. I really feel like it's helped bring down my stress level and give me some more clarity in my day.
Would you say that you meditate also when you run? Because you don't listen to anything when you run. You just love to be out there in the solitude, right? So
yeah, running is my time to think. So I guess I usually try to pray and, you know, think of the needs of others while I'm out there, think of things that I'm thankful for. And then the rest of the time, I just let my mind wander and think of whatever I feel like, you know, to solve little problems that pop into my head or think about silly things or nothing at all. You know, I wouldn't say my runs are totally focused.
When you think about silly things, does an image of me pop up in your imagination at that point?
No.
Okay. All right. That's good. It's good to know.
I leave you behind.
Oh.
I do pray for you.
Okay. Thanks. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And Angie's going to answer a question that was sent in about sickness and training. Should you continue with marathon training if you get sick, or should you lay up and rest for a while?
Yes, this is actually a question I get a lot, especially during this time of the year when many people are dealing with various viral or bacterial infections. And it says, hello, Angie. Well, as much as I tried to avoid getting sick this season, it happened. I suffered through a brief head cold and it is now settled into my chest. I've been coughing and wheezing for the past 7 days. I haven't run in about 10 days. My question is, now that my training schedule has been thrown off, where and how do I pick it up again? And how do I know when it's safe to run outside in the cold? After my cough settles down, suggestions are more than welcome. And that comes from Lori. So definitely, Lori, I'm sorry that you've been sick. And since I'm not a doctor, my advice is not a substitute for the advice of your doctor. And I think it's important that if you've had a serious sickness or something that you can't kick, that you do get some medical advice just to make sure you're not dealing with something more serious. But the general guideline is that if the symptoms are below the neck, you shouldn't run, especially if it's accompanied by fever, shortness of breath, or body aches. in these situations, the best thing that you can do is to rest and push the fluids. And it sounds like you've been resting for about 10 days. So you've been giving your immune system plenty of chances to fight back and get stronger. However, if you're not feverish or you're not short of breath and it's been that period of time, I'd recommend that you try some indoor cross training, yoga, cycling, elliptical, maybe even a little bit of treadmill to see how your body tolerates that. If the coughing doesn't bother you too much, you're not feeling short of breath, then you'll probably be okay to take it outside. Then you just need to pick up your training plan in the week that you're supposed to be in and just forget what you missed, because there's really no sense in trying to go back and make up runs and fit it all in. If you have a decent running base, then you should just be able to go to the week where you're supposed to be in and just continue on as if nothing has happened. And then as you're running outside, make sure that you take the pace really easy for that first week, just to let your body get used to the increased activity level. And if you find that the cold air is bothering your breathing, you might want to try kind of a thin balaclava over your mouth just to kind of filter and warm that air before it goes in. So just listen to your body. And if you feel more comfortable training indoors when you're coughing, then that would be fine. And just take it really easy outside and get back into your routine.
And if you want more information on running and marathon training, be sure to visit us online. Our website is marathontrainingacademy.com. When you're there, you can join our mailing list and stay abreast of what's going on, and also find our smart training plans and recommended resources, and check out how to join the academy and go through our premium training courses and interact with us and our online members community. We really appreciate you listening to this podcast. We're so happy to be on this running journey with you, and we want you to remember that you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life.
The heart is a blue, shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for.